Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn. Late Night Live, ideas and opinions from around the world.
Welcome, dear listeners, Gladys and Poddies, to the Best of LNL from 2008. Later in the program, we'll revisit an interview I had with Barry Day, who's edited a book of Noel Coward's letters. But first to the President of Iran. Under his tutelage, the place is going from strength to strength. It's isolated its enemies, put them on the defensive. Iran's economy is flourishing. It's attracting unprecedented levels of foreign investment. It is Iran that is imposing sanctions on unfriendly countries. It's already sitting at the high table of nuclear powers, and people around the world are with the president. The world is being Ahmadinejadized. This is make-believe to outside observers of Iran, but what I've just read you is a scenario fervently believed in by many of the country's elite, and none more so than the president himself. After his election in 2005, he quickly passed into caricature in the Western media, both mocked and demonised. That diminutive blacksmith's son with a beaming grin, and an apocalyptic visionary who denies the Holocaust, and who seems intent on playing a game of nuclear chicken with the US. Iranian journalist Khazra Naji has written an extensively researched, and I think carefully balanced, biography of the Iranian president. It's called Ahmadinejad, A Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. And when Khazra joined me from the BBC studios in London, I told him I still remembered the shock the wider world felt when this bloke won the presidency in a landslide. And in fact, according to Khazra, he was almost as surprised and shocked himself.
Almost. Yes, it was completely surprising. We were journalists based in Iran at the time, and there was five or six other candidates, and we were looking at all of these, but not Ahmadinejad. Very, very few people expected Ahmadinejad to do well at all, let alone win 17 million votes. But having said all this, obviously to him and his supporters, they were working on this for months, if not years, and they had been sort of placing themselves in important strategic areas to basically manage this election the way they wanted and win the election in the end.
Okay, so what did they see in him? What was it about this, the son of a blacksmith, that made them believe he was up to it?
Well, he managed to pull 17 million votes, but I don't know how many of those people actually knew him before voting for him. Many may have voted for him because they decided that he was better than others. But there's a lot of all sorts of legitimate and illegitimate means were used also to make sure that Ahmadinejad will come on top. He had very strong backings from the militia Basij in the country, had a very strong support from sections of the Revolutionary Guards, and also support from hardline clergymen who sent a young clergyman across the country to remote areas to bring out the vote for Ahmadinejad.
So we're talking about a genuine grassroots campaign, so not a huge media campaign.
A genuine grassroots campaign to some extent, but also it's clear that the Revolutionary Guards and the Basij used all their military muscle and organizational muscle to bring out the vote for Mr. Ahmadinejad.
Now, after his election, I recall claims that he was involved in the 1979 hostage taking at the US Embassy. Is there evidence for that?
Not hard evidence, no. In fact, soon after he was elected, there was a picture that appeared in newspapers of one of the hostage takers holding on to one of the American hostages with a blindfold on him. And the opposition, Mujahideen-e Khalq people, they led this campaign to say that this man in the picture is Ahmadinejad. In fact, as the CIA and other people who checked the facts and checked the pictures and the similarities came to the conclusion that this was not the case and the man in the picture was not Ahmadinejad. But we don't know what Mr. Ahmadinejad did during that period. Obviously, according to other hostage takers, he wanted to be involved, but other hostage takers at the time, they didn't trust him and they didn't let him near the U.S. embassy building where the hostages were held, not initially anyway.
He has a quite messianic view of the world and of himself. Is this come out of his personality or does it come out of his form of religious belief?
His religious belief is very, very strong. He comes from a sect within the Shiite brand of Islam. And these are very few in numbers, the members of this sect, who believe that the Shiite Muslim's missing Imam, the Mahdi, is going to come very soon, much sooner than many expect. And that has basically colored all his actions, his view of the world, and his place within Iran and in history.
And he does have a view of a sort of an Islamic variation on the Second Coming.
That's right. He has told the Iranian leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, soon after he was sworn in as president, that he believed that he will hand over power to the Mahdi at the end of his term. So this is a man who, with very strong belief in religious beliefs, just imagine, like, for example, a very extreme sect within the Christian evangelical church to come to power in the United States. It's more or less like this.
But that almost happened, Kasra, didn't it?
Well, almost. But you can, Ahmadinejad belongs to even more extreme more extreme case, if you like, if you want to draw the parallel to those people in Washington. So, you know, even in Iran's Shiite dominated political system, he's an oddity.
Your book is full of examples of his passionate character, his emotional intensity. For example, when giving an award to a teacher from his own primary school against all of his doctrinaire Islamic beliefs, he took up the elderly woman's hand and kissed it, and she'd been made to wear long black gloves to ensure no skin-to-skin contact.
That's right. Yes, he is very emotional indeed, and the sort of thing you just explained means that sometimes the emotions get better of him and he says and does things that he might come to regret, or he might he might not do in normal circumstances. Many of his statements might be categorized within that category, in a sense that they were very emotional.
And the contradictions are echoed or amplified in his relationship with foreign powers. You point out that on one hand we've got his vehement anti-US stance, a central plank really of his presidency, but you suggest that a part of him would also like to be the bloke who breaks the diplomatic deadlock with the US.
That's the general feeling amongst people who are working close with him. These people have told me that in their high-level meetings, Ahmadinejad constantly says that he believes that Iran and the U.S. are going to come to blows sooner or later, and that Iran has to prepare itself for that eventuality. But at the same time, as you say, he has traveled to the United States several times before, and he wants to open up channels to the U.S., and generally the impression is that he would like to be the person who unlocks the relationship between Iran and the United States if he can. But at the end of the day, he doesn't really think that is going to be possible.
Kasra, I can't help but remember his subtleties in his performance in the US. He was, you know, the comedians, the television comics went berserk with him as a target. But I remember that performance at the university where, you know, he was almost charming. And despite the protestations of repressed rage by the university that hosted him, there was almost a hint of conciliation.
Yes, you're referring to his speech at Columbia University in New York just 8-9 months ago. It was odd in the sense that Ahmadinejad, to me, seemed to get the better of the situation, because the chancellor of the university behaved so badly, in my view. The chancellor of the university rubbished him, and he said words that basically chancellors and university lecturers don't say, because they are supposed to encourage students to see both sides, to encourage
objectively. It was a shabby performance, and he endured it with a degree of grace, which was surprising.
But at the end of the day, Ahmadinejad went to Iran and declared that this was a victory. And it wasn't anything close to a victory. If anything, Iran and his government had been pretty badly insulted during this trip. If, for example, previous President Khatami had visited the United States and visited New York or Columbia University, or even before him, President Rafsanjani, they would not have received this kind of hostile reaction.
Mind you, Kasra, nor would they have provoked it quite as deliberately, because New York was reeling with shock from his hosting of that conference of Holocaust deniers in 2006, and his anti-Jewish diatribes are legend. Yeah.
That's right. At New York, that doesn't go down too well for the president of the country, a country, to come and say Israel should be wiped off the map, or that Jews have to be moved to Alaska, or Europeans have to set aside a place within Europe for Jews to move Jews to Europe. All these statements, of course, are inflammatory. To me, it basically conveys the message that Ahmadinejad doesn't know the outside world, doesn't know how the world works.
How does it play back in Iran? Many sophisticated Iranians must be quite baffled by his Holocaust myth crusade.
Yes, I mean, a lot of people in Iran were telling me and saying these things openly in the press and elsewhere, that basically this is wrong. Holocaust did happen, A, and B, why are we getting involved in something which is none of our business and something that is going to cost us dearly? And still there's no answer for this. There is no clear answer why Ahmadinejad and his supporters did what they did and said what they said about wiping off Israel off the map and moving Jews to Alaska or wherever.
You're listening to Late Night Live Highlights on ABC Radio National Summer. It's a chat I had with Iranian journalist Kasra Naji in May, and it's about the Iranian president with all his contradictions. One of the themes of the book is that you suggest he... Well, you've just said it, in fact, that he's profoundly unaware of the depth of reaction that he's provoking in the West.
I think he's very naive, and he knows very little about the outside world, and he's almost illiterate in terms of international relations, the case in point being a letter he wrote, a personal letter to Chancellor Merkel of Germany, inviting Germany to join Iran in an alliance against the victors of the Second World War. I don't know what possessed Ahmadinejad to say such a thing. I would have thought Iranian foreign ministry experts would be there to tell him that this is not the sort of thing you would do, or this is not an alliance that is going to happen. But nevertheless, it's there. The letter is there, and he's written it, and he's asked the Chancellor of Germany to join Iran against the rest of the world.
The issue, of course, which most agitates the West has been his nuclear ambitions. How do you see them? What are they?
I think for hardliners in Iran, they want to achieve the nuclear capability. And I emphasize capability because they think once we show that we can do it or we have the capability to do it, then the balance of power in the region is going to change in favor of Iran, and the United States and Israel are not going to be threatening Iran every 5 minutes. So that's the general view. The plan, so far as I can understand, so far as I can read, so far as some people tell me in Iran, is that Ahmadinejad and his hardliners would like to see Iran go all the way, short of actually detonating a bomb, to have the capability and to show the world that they are capable of producing it if and when the need arises. That's the idea. And they think by doing that, they're going to change the balance of power in favor of Iran. And this is the basic the strategic plan of the hardliners in Iran if they continue in power, if they stay in power.
Kasra, in terms of domestic politics, it would seem very difficult, if not impossible, for him to back down for this enthusiasm.
Yes, and he doesn't show any inclination to backing down. He wants to go forward. There's no going back. He has this religious belief that he's the chosen one, if you like. He's on a mission. He cannot go wrong. And time is running out. He has to do it. He doesn't have time to discuss this or study this or that issue. We have to do things. This is why he comes up with very sort of quick decisions for very complicated issues, and he believes that they're doing the right thing.
Well, he obviously needs to change his therapist or increase his medication. Is there anyone, any group who are constraining him? Tell me that someone's holding him back.
Even within the hardline Islamists in Iran now, there are these strong faction who today have the upper hand in the Iranian parliament, who believe that Ahmadinejad is going too far, particularly with the economy and his economic policies, if you can call them that, and they want to rein him in, basically. But this parliament has just been sworn in, and we have to wait and see how far they're going to get. Apart from them, the major centers of power, like Iran's supreme leader, like Iran's revolutionary guards, like the Basij, like hardline clergymen, they all support him, and he enjoys the support. And as long as that support continues, I think he will be safe where he is.
But Kasra, you also point out that while he won in a landslide, his popularity has been in a nosedive since he came to office. Is this a feeling, or are there fairly accurate opinion polls in Iran?
No, there are no accurate opinion polls in Iran. So generally, you just have to read the situation the best you can. My own impression is that he enjoys a lot of support now, even more than he did before, in remote and rural areas, because he constantly visits these areas. He goes and talks to these people in remote areas. He promises them money. He promises them roads, bridges, telephone lines, electricity, you name it. And these are the people who didn't have any hope because previously none of the Iranian leaders would visit them. And now he regularly visits these areas, promises them all sorts of things, and he wins their support. My own impression is that in rural areas, he enjoys more support than he did before, but not in cities, in big cities particularly, because the situation with the economy is getting out of control. The prices are up and nobody has time for Ahmadinejad.
Kazra, a couple of weeks ago I talked to a very fine English historian on the early life of Stalin, the young Stalin. Let's go back to his childhood, because I just want you to tell us what clues we can find there. He makes a lot of his humble upbringing, his humble background. How humble, in fact, was it?
Yes, the childhood. He comes from a village which is on the edge of a salt desert in central Iran. I visited it, and the place is a sad place. It's dusty, it's poor, there are no young people there, there are few shops that there are closed, not many people around, and the place has got the look of those one of those forgotten towns, if you like, you see in Western films, in Back or Beyond in Texas, that are forgotten and nothing happens in these places. It's that kind of a scene when I visited it. His family were very poor. His father had a barber's shop to begin with in this village, and then that didn't work. He opened a grocery shop. That didn't work. He decided to move to Tehran in those days, we're talking about 50 years ago, to search for a better life, and he didn't have a penny, and he had five children already, so he moved his children to the edge of the capital in Tehran in the hope of finding a better life for himself and his children. There he struck lucky in a sense that he went into a joint venture with some of his family members, opening a blacksmith's shop, producing doors and windows, steel doors and windows. And from then on, things got better. And Ahmadinejad, by the time he was at the age of high school, 15, 16, he went to an expensive private high school in Tehran. So from then on, things looked up for him. He doesn't come from a working class background, as he claims. He comes from a poor background, but nevertheless, from a very religious background. His father, his mother, they had Quran reading classes in their homes almost on a weekly basis throughout his life. He was brought up to live next door to a mosque, to visit the mosque as if it was his home, and generally the upbringing, an extremely religious upbringing.
There were moments in the young Stalin's life when his mother, at least, was pushing him into the priesthood. She saw for Stalin a religious future rather than a political one. Well, we know what happened with that. Was there a time when the parental pressure on Ahmadinejad was towards a fully committed religious life as opposed to one that is politically expressed?
I think at that time, when Ahmadinejad was growing up into a fine young man, if you like, there was no question of entering politics. Iran was under the Shah at the time, under the monarchy regime, and getting into politics was definitely not encouraged. People wouldn't think of going into politics because there was no freedom, and the politics belonged to the Shah and his close circle of friends. So those days, I would have thought religion was the main issue. But Ahmadinejad came to the age of being a university student just at the right time, at the time when there was a revolution in 1979. He entered the universities, and you can imagine, at the time of a revolutionary upheaval in Iran, what kind of atmosphere governs university, and he was thrown into that atmosphere of, you know, full-time politics, very sort of campaigning politics, left-dominated universities, and religious students like Ahmadinejad had to fight for their places, had to fight for their ideology, if you like, because the universities at that time in Iran were dominated by left-wing politics.
Kasra, how will your book be treated or greeted in Iran? Will it be available, or will it be snuck in people's luggage?
Interestingly enough, I had a message from a friend of mine who had seen my book being sold in Iran during the recent international book fair in Tehran. And I have a publisher friend who was hopeful at one point. Excuse me, I've got a cold. He was hopeful at one point that he could translate the book. But I'm not so optimistic. I think we have to wait and see. The authorities have to give it a green light before it can get published in Iran. So I'm not that optimistic, actually. But the fact that the book was available during the book fair is encouraging.
Now, finally, there's a lot of things impinging on his role in life, including, as you were saying before, economic mismanagement. Do you think he's a semi-permanent fixture? Do you think he'll be around in 5 years, 10 years?
If I could hazard a guess, I would say yes. I would say yes, because I think the people who have brought him to power and they are backing him today, the hardliners, the extreme hardliners, the right-wing fringe who today rules in Iran, they have no intention of letting go of power in Iran. Whatever needs to be done, if it's going to be legitimate means, illegitimate means, cheating, whatever, they will do to make sure that he will remain in power.
That was Iranian journalist Kasra Naji talking to me last May. His book, Ahmadinejad, The Secret History of Iran's Radical Leader. It's published by University of Chicago Press. This is part of LNL's summer series of highlights on ABC Radio National. And now sit back for a few moments, relax, and have a listen to this, after which I'll be talking to Barry Day, author of The Letters of Noel Coward. That's the wonderful lyrics of Noel Coward, one of the most prolific, talented figures to emerge from the 20th century. Rattle off the things he was good at: playwriting, composing, lyrics, of course, acting, producing. And it turns out he was even a bit of a wartime spy. His close friend, Lord Louis Mountbatten, said at his 70th birthday that there are probably greater painters than Noel Coward, greater novelists, librettists, composers of music, greater singers, greater dancers, greater comedians, greater stage producers, film directors, cabaret artists, and film actors. But if there are, they are 12 different people. Only one man combined all 12, the master. Now, throughout his life, Coward wrote over 50 plays and 20 films as writer, director, and or star. He did a ballet, hundreds of songs, some of which I know by heart, his autobiography, a novel, his 30-year diary, several volumes of short stories and poems, as well as the odd daub and sketch. Widely regarded as a genius, I think certainly by his good self, he had an extraordinary talent for friendship, and I must say also an equal talent for malice. His long list of correspondents included Dietrich, Laurence Olivier, Alec Guinness, Virginia Woolf, Somerset Maugham, Ian Fleming, Graham Greene, and the Queen Mother, to whom he wrote most irreverently. Now, a collection of previously unpublished letters to his friends and his mum sheds further light on Coward, and also brings to life an era which is rather sadly vanished. Barry Day. Barry is the editor of the new book. It's called The Letters of Noel Coward. Barry is an authority. No, he's not. He's the authority on a man, on the man. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and a trustee of the Noel Coward Foundation and the author of oodles of books on Mr. Coward. And he joins us from his home, and I think this is a wonderful address for him to live in these days, Palm Beach, Florida. Barry, welcome.
Good morning.
Many books written about Coward. He's also written his autobiography in, as I recall, two parts. Lots known about him, and certainly you would have known everything. Did you discover anything you didn't know in the letters?
Well, I discovered a few things that I'd suspected and there'd been hints of, but the letters proved it. For instance, his occupation during the war, when he was under great attack from the British government and the press for not being involved, as they thought. But in fact, he had been spying since about 1937 for the Foreign Office, and that comes clearly out of his letters to and from them. And in his usual fashion, it's rather wryly put. I mean, he said, I thought being a spy would be more like Mata Hari, but then I thought, well, not really. I couldn't wear a jewel in my navel, as I believe she was given to doing. So the whole style of his, everything he wrote, had that kind of ironic touch, I think, which is why it's funny to younger generations today.
So I'm surprised that you suggest he wouldn't wear a jewel in his navel.
Come on. Straighten out.
One of the things, years ago when I discovered this, I was astonished. I'd always assumed that Coward, you know, was a fag at Eton or something, and then, you know, he was born and bred Knightsbridge, but he was, he created this persona, didn't he? Because he was the son of a piano salesman.
Yeah, I mean, he did choir school, from which he was fired for being too dramatic when he sang, and the rest of it was picked up as he went along. I mean, he educated himself. He learned rather than was taught. But he was an open mind. I mean, I always think of him, the more I think about him, as a sort of a conduit. You know, things would come at him. He would absorb them through the pores, and then he would express them. But it was not done through the power of intellect. He wasn't a silly man, but he wasn't an educated man. In fact, he said in several places how blessed he was. He said, my good fortune was to have a bright, acquisitive, but not an intellectual mind, and to have been impelled by circumstance to get out and earn my living and help with the installments on the house.
You know, some of that could be equally applied, of course, to Shakespeare.
Certainly could, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, in a way, there is a definition of genius, I would think, isn't it? That you can actually let things come through you and give them shape without knowing what it is you're going to do with it.
The other thing I'd forgotten was how young he was when he first, you know, made it big, the success of The Vortex. He was 24.
That's right.
Did he immediately or subsequently fall into the celebrity trap of believing his own hype?
I think again the irony comes into it. He was well aware that this was not the real Noel Coward, but he was also quite intent on shaping something called Noel Coward behind which he could hide, which he certainly did. And he was probably one of the first examples of a celebrity, somebody who was famous for being well-known and well-known for being famous. He found it very amusing and very helpful. And he picked it up, and even in the war years when he was the spy, he said, I would go out and be Noel Coward, singing my little songs, being a bit of a silly ass. It was my best disguise.
Of course, he wasn't the first theatrical celebrity and, if you like, multi-trained genius in Britain, in England, because Oscar Wilde predates him a little.
He did, but Oscar Wilde didn't sing and dance, to my knowledge.
And I don't think he was a spy.
Well, if he was, it was in the privacy of the bedroom. But lots of the things Coward did, Wilde did not do. And the funny thing is that Coward did not particularly admire Wilde, or perhaps he was jealous of him. He thought he was silly and affected, and when he did the adaptation of Lady Windermere's Fan into After the Ball, he said to himself, we're going to get as much Wild out of this, as much Coward into it as possible, which is not a wise decision, because he was doing it to be unwild, as it were, and the two stars didn't mesh particularly well. The show is interesting, but it's not great for that reason alone.
My guest is Barry Day, and we're channeling Noel Coward. Let me read his philosophy, dear listener. My philosophy is as simple as ever. I love smoking, drinking, moderate sexual intercourse on a diminishing scale, reading and writing, not arithmetic, and I have a selfless absorption in the well-being and achievements of Noel Coward. And there you see the point you're making, that Noel Coward's almost a brand name.
Yes, he was, that's right. But we have more or less branded it legally. But yeah, he was also concerned that he would be forgotten, which is a strange thing to think about now or even then. But he said, well, you know, if people don't remember me, that's too bad. But clearly he wanted to be remembered, and clearly he has been. And he's probably bigger now than he ever was, with all the performances, with all the an exhibition at the National Theatre in London. The book comes out. We do a little play based on the letters.
Going back to Mrs. Worthington, this advice to the theatrical mother, was some of that perhaps addressed to his mother, Violet, who made such sacrifices to jumpstart his career?
I think it was. I think theatre mothers everywhere. And, of course, he knew other people like Ivan Novello, who had the same kind of phenomenon. But it's interesting what he said about the song afterwards. He said, it is a genuine creed occur. Unhappily, its effectiveness from the point of view of propaganda has been negligible. I had hoped by writing it to discourage misguided maternal ambition, to deter those dreadful eager mothers from making beasts of themselves, boring the hell out of me and wasting their time and my own, but I've not succeeded. 99 out of 100 of the letters they write to me refer to it with roguish indulgence, obviously secure in the conviction it could not in any circumstance apply to them. It's saddening, of course, but realizing that the road of the social reformer is paved with disillusions, I have determined to rise above it.
Let me steam open a letter here addressed to Mum. Dear darling old Mummy Snooks, you are such a darling, and I know you don't love Daddy and Eric nearly as much as me.
He was a mummy's boy. He said so. He said, I'm a mummy's boy, and I shall be, I expect, till the day I die. He was quite proud of all that, and when he was young and writing home from tour, he'd say, well, I cry a bit every night, you know, but it's nothing to speak of. Oh, by the way, are the two vests of mine at home? The two I'm wearing seem a little congealed. I mean, he writes like a young boy. What I found fascinating in compiling these things is the evolution of a person, you know, the shaping of a person, and beyond a point, the deliberate creation of a kind of a mask to be behind. But no, as a young kid, he wrote like young kids write, misspelled, touching in many ways.
But later he'd write to the Queen Mum in almost an identical tone of voice. There's that sweet little letter he writes her after the death of hubby.
Mm.
It's, you know, it's very irreverent, it's very intimate and very cheeky.
Well, they were good pals. I mean, there's a picture in the book of the two of them huddling under a blanket when they were watching some sporting event at Windsor, and they're giggling together. And they're just two chums. For instance, when we had the memorial service back in the 80s for him, she came and officiated. And Graham Payne, who handled Coward Estate by that time, said to her, Ma'am, thank you for coming. Thank you so much. And she said, very simply, because I was standing there, I came because he was my friend, she said. And that's the way it was.
There's a vast variety of people of comparable celebrity to himself included in the correspondence. Are we talking genuine friendship, or are we talking networking?
Well, you're talking networking for sure, because he would make lists as a young man of the people he knew, the people he could say hi to, the people, you know, he could have a conversation with. Yeah, he was well aware of that. But out of that developed some genuine friendships. I mean, for say, Gertie Lawrence, for sure. Olivier, to a point, but that's soured after all. But no, there are a lot of those people. And he created his own family, don't forget. Other than his mum, because the father died, the younger brother died, his family was people like Cole Leslie, his secretary, Lorne Lorraine, his secretary, Joyce Carey, the actress, Clements Dane, the sculptress and writer, and Graham, of course. And they were the ones on whom he relied.
There's quite conscious and deliberate ambiguity or parody in, say, this letter to Virginia Woolf in 1928. I am hot and glowing after reading Orlando, and I am completely at your feet. It is the finest book de nos jours, and if I continue to flatter you like this, would you agree to become another of my top 500 bestest chums?
Yes, there's a little bit of a self-serving going on in that. I think, among other things, which Mountbatten's not this, he was a snob. And he thought of her as being a serious writer, and he wanted her goodwill, which he got for a while. And then she said to somebody else that he's too clever by half, too clever, what's that effect, and that fell apart. But he was always, and increasingly in life, looking to be a better writer. And funnily enough, in my view, the more he tried that, the more good books he read, the Proust, the Tolstoy's, the worse he became as a writer himself, because he became rather more mannered.
He had quite good, generous relationships with contemporaries and competitors, in a sense. I'm thinking about Terence Rattigan.
Yeah.
Because Rattigan had even more commercial success than Noel for a brief time.
He did indeed, and he got the knighthood and so on. Yeah, it was. They got on well. Most people, when they first came across Noel, and Rattigan was a good example when he was at university, felt obliged to be critical because everybody else was so pro. But that was, again, an attitude being taken almost professionally and competitively. When he got to know Noel, they became extremely close friends.
There's a similar story. No, it's not similar, but there's an equally interesting story about Graham Greene, who, as you point out, was one of the dissenting voices on Coward's play Blithe Spirit, which Greene dismissed as a weary exhibition of bad taste. But when they finally meet, he likes Green, and he seems to have forgotten his, quote, past beastliness.
Yes, forgiven but not forgotten, I think he says, doesn't he, at one point. They did become quite good friends, and why not? I think when talent finds genuine talent, that's going to happen. You see it later in life with other playwrights. I mean, he was critical of the kitchen sink school of drama until the time when John Osborne wrote to him and almost wagged a finger in a coward-esque fashion and said, come on, we don't need you to tell us how to write plays. We admire what you're doing, probably more than you think. As a result of that, they got together and became good friends. And he certainly got to know Pinter very well.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I was fascinated by the fact that he reaches out to the young Pinter after reading The Homecoming.
Well, he didn't understand him to begin with, because he said, you break every rule of playwriting I've been taught to believe in, but you are never boring for 1 minute, and I think I get what you're doing now. And they did become quite close. And you could argue very easily, and I would, that to be Pinteresque is also to be cowardesque. The words say something, but they imply a great deal more beneath the surface. What is not said is indicated for you as the audience to pick it up. And there aren't too many playwrights who have that quality.
He had an ambivalent attitude, did he not, to Larry Boy, to Olivia?
He did, yeah. I mean, he virtually discovered him as a very rising young actor when he put him into Private Lives, and they got on pretty well. But I think Olivier was a very vain man, probably not necessarily a very pleasant one overall. Many people say that. And, of course, when Olivier, when the star rose and on the titles and everything came with it, there was a beginning of a drift there, and they really fell out over the Vivien Leigh episode when Vivien Leigh was pregnant in Coward's play and nobody told him, and then she left it and so on. He didn't like that very much, no.
I remember, and I think it was about 2 years ago, Barry, I interviewed Arthur Miller, who was a lifelong hero of mine, and I didn't realise how close it was to his death. And I decided that I wouldn't mention Marilyn Monroe. I'm going to be the one person who interviews Miller about his writing and not about his missus. And in the course of the interview, Miller brought Monroe up every 10 seconds. It was, you know, quite extraordinary performance. So I like the letter. He writes to, you know, Noel writes to Larry Boy about his relief when Mr. and Mrs. Arthur Miller declined his invitation to lunch. And he remembers being at Clifton's in Hollywood, where he sat for 2 hours at a tiny table with Marilyn Monroe and felt at the end of 2 hours a piercing need for a whiff of oxygen.
That's right. He called it the blonde bottom, didn't he? Yes, he didn't seem to have a great deal to offer in the conversational or social line. The interesting other relationship, I think, and I'm sure you picked this up, is with Churchill, because there was a definite mixture of feelings there. Each admired the other, but there was always an edge, and I think a lot of it was to do with these two huge egos. I mean, Churchill was an actor as well, and when he was there, he wanted to be centre stage. Well, that's hard when you've got Noel at a party. A touch of homophobia probably as well. And, of course, he was the one who stopped Noel's knighthood in 1942, which the king had already approved.
Yes, that's a nasty story. I don't like that at all. Let's deal with sexuality. His long-term partner, Graham Payne, and you point out in the book that it wasn't until the end of his life that he dealt overtly with the subject of homosexuality in what was it called?
Sweet in Twilight. Song of Twilight.
Yeah. He had, of course, written Mad About the Boy, which was a fairly confronting song.
Well, there are many things that he wrote where you can take it either way. I mean, you can take Design for Living as a genuine ménage à trois. But he always believed that implication was stronger than statement, and a lot of his things can be taken by the middle-class audience that does not want to get into all that as being one thing, and if you happen to have a different persuasion, you can see it another way. But one of the things that has always concerned me in recent years is the way that there are those who want to turn him into a gay icon. Rebecca West said of him at one point, he was a very dignified man. There was an impeccable dignity in his sexual life, which was reticent but untainted by pretense. And I do believe that was the case from all I've heard and what Graham used to say and his other friends. Yes, he was gay.
I think he handled that part of his life with enormous style, actually, in marked contrast to some others. Well, talking about people of ambiguous sexuality, Thomas Edward Lawrence, or Lawrence of Arabia. We were discussing him on the program a few weeks ago, and I wish I'd had your book at the time. I could have read this out. Lawrence used to preface his letters with his Royal Air Force serial number 338171. So Coward replies, "Dear 338171, may I call you 338?
Yeah, that's one of his better lines, I think. They're quite good pals, because they've got things in common. I mean, they both love words, and for a while, and of course he didn't live long, they became correspondents and saw each other from time to time. Now, whether there was an affair there, we will never know. What amuses me is people keep looking at different names saying, oh, was there an affair there, the Duke of Kent, or whatever, whatever? Well, we will never know for sure. You know, there's some clearly there were, and some you'll never know.
Why did Churchill give him the thumbs down on the knighthood?
Well, as I say, I think personal jealousy had a lot to do with it. And although they made up over the years to a degree, and in fact Coward was the host of the celebration on television for Churchill's 90th, it was never that easy. There was something about me Noel said that he didn't like. He couldn't quite define it. But I think the technicality behind it was very simple. Noel was sent in his capacity during the early years of the war to America, when America was neutral, to report back on attitude and so on and so on. He got to know Roosevelt much better, much quicker than Churchill did, all of which is in the book. And I think then, when he came back, those that didn't like him picked upon the fact that he had been spending his own money to do this. He wasn't paid. He used his own resources. That was a technical crime, because finances had been frozen at the outbreak of war, but nobody had told Noel. His accountant and ex-lover, Jack Wilson, should have done, but didn't bother. So he'd actually broken a law, and he was taken to court, and he was fined. So Churchill could say to the king, and does say in a letter, this is too recent and too serious an offence. It would look as if we were, you know, ignoring it or rewarding it, and I cannot in all conscience advise Your Majesty to proceed with this. And that was that. The Prime Minister could stop it. The King had pre-approved it, but he didn't get it. He didn't get it for nearly 30 years.
That was Barry Day, editor of The Letters of Noel Coward, published by Methuen. Barry was talking to me from his home in Palm Beach, Florida, back in January. Exactly the sort of address that Noel enjoyed. Next on LNL's Summer Highlights, a discussion about Rupert Murdoch's foray into China, and an independent historian, Babette Smith, talks about Australia's convict stain. And because it's summer, let's go out on another Noel Coward song.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.